So, Derek, is the reason that you do that, is the reason that you have start off with closed activities and then go to open, just because you find that people need some time to develop their confidence. That's it. Okay.
What if you had a group that were, I mean, I imagine that you're doing this because you might be assuming that the people you're working with in your course are not familiar with these technologies. What if you had people already familiar with these technologies and had already experienced a course like the one your model that you're pointing up? Would you then forego the closed idea if it is only there for building confidence and things like that? I mean, I can imagine there are subjects such as the subjects that the participants in this course teach to do with therapy and occupational therapy and midwifery and things like that, that they feel they need the closed bit to discuss issues of privacy and things like that. But in your instance, that's, confidential stuff. So if you had students who had already experienced this model, would you forego the closed?
No, I think you've got it. You can head quicker into things, but I think even in a totally open environment, sometimes we have little meetings where we just discuss things that probably is in-house. It's not in the sense of private, it's just better to be there.
So the inverse question, why would we go open? I mean, I've got my ideas and stuff. I'm curious to know if anyone else has got ideas on that, Derek, and any challenges to the idea of open?
Look, I'll start with a sub-question then. What would be some of the advantages of running an open activity?
Just for the recorded audio, Dave just answered that one with outside participation, and Caroline with better for shared learning. And are they necessarily good? I mean, this course, for example, has obviously attracted outside participation and will hopefully result in enrollments later on for the assessment purposes and money and all that sort of thing. But the outside participation, has it been an enhancement? Has it been a distraction? Has it added to the workload of the students and the facilitators and things like that? So is open for, you know, there are good reasons there, but is it necessarily good all the time?
Can I make a comment to that, Lee? I'm just thinking with the 10-minute lectures that we started, maybe we could have had the class plotting through activities on Blackboard, you know, in the closed environment, and then waited for quite a while before we started the 10-minute lectures, which actually invited outside participation. And I'm just wondering what the rest of the class thinks. Would they have preferred to work through the self-paced activities in the closed environment on Blackboard for a lot longer than they did before being exposed to the wider world?
Look, I'll chip in here. I think there's something indefinable and special about little intersections with outside participants. For example, if you run a blog, let's say 60 people read the blog and don't do anything, and one person comes along and reads the blog and adds a little bit of a comment, and someone else might add a bit more of a comment, the kind of the feedback effect of that little thing is quite remarkable. I think in some of our courses, the openness to other participants in the course as well and the people right outside adds a little touch of magic.
I think it's quite quite amazing. The thing that I find amazing about blogging is that you can put your thoughts out there and in a very short space of time effectively get peer reviewed on what's going on with you and get a whole range of different perspectives from different people who are also involved in the same, or have the same interests that you do. I think it's, yeah, that's the thing I've been finding amazing.
But is the comparison to peer review accurate? I mean, there's the claim that blogging is an echo chamber. You get comments mainly from people who agree with you, and very rarely do you get comments to people who critique you, and when you do, they're often pretty harsh and heavy-handed. So there's a problem with blogging in terms of that idea of peer review, in that they perhaps don't necessarily give you the type of feedback that you may need.
Yes, point taken, Lee. I think I should say that we have to have a pretty good structure and scaffolding to any reflective process inside of a class or a course or that kind of thing, because what people say is, I like that, I learned a lot, and it's almost, without a bit of structure, some kind of reflective process, it's just bland.
Yeah, I think in this course, anyway, I've been noticing that people are fairly comfortable actually giving constructive criticism, which is good. I mean, that's the stuff that's actually maybe more useful in some ways. The affirming comments are nice, but yeah.
You might not have... Oh, I'm sure you have noticed, David, but I'm not sure if the others have, but usually when I give comments, I always like to ask more questions, because I think, you know, if you just end with a dead statement or whatever and not ask further questions to get people thinking, it doesn't help them lead anywhere. So that's how I like to do it. I don't know about others. Do you do that as well?
One of the things I noticed in terms of comments on blogs is that one of the presenters, mental block on her name, Barrington, but one of the presenters made a very diligent effort in commenting for quite a while on the participants who were blogging her presentation. And I've still got a mental block on her name. I know it very well, but anyway, those who have been in this course would know that. Yeah, thank you, Nancy White. And I think that was a really good demonstration of the value of comments, especially coming from somebody with, say, celebrity status like Nancy White, at least in our course, who had given a 10-minute presentation and a quite an inspiring one, and then followed up with lengthy comments on people's blogs. And that was in the initial stages of our course, having participants setting up blogs and stuff, and I think that was actually quite seminal in helping our participants appreciate blogging and commenting and open communication and things like that, in, from my point of view anyway.
I'll just throw in one little problem that we've had, and in some respects I haven't known how to handle this, and this has happened at least twice quite significantly in a one of our open to the world courses. Someone's gone off on a tangent, and I mean a real tangent, and gone right out there so far and so fast before I really realised what had happened. In one case, the guy set up a whole website with a wiki, and yet the basic premise of what he was doing, well, he just hadn't quite thought it through. I really never quite recovered from that in that particular course. And it was only really in the last two or three weeks that he kind of emerged with in another area, but just out of interest.
Well, perhaps to bring it closer to home here, is when we have somebody make a criticism of the way the course is run, and that risks. think it has in this course, but it has in other courses and stuff. It risks kind of altering the motivations and engagement in the course and things like that, especially if you have, and I don't think we have in this course, but if you have the majority of participants who are not really motivated to be doing the subject, you know, they have to for professional development reasons, or they've enrolled and it just happens to be they've enrolled in a program and this course happens to be part of the program whether they like it or not. So your motivation levels in the participant group is quite low, and then you have somebody make a heavy and accurate criticism that can disable the thing, just like your example, Derek, of somebody going off on a tangent. And how do we respond to that sort of thing?
Look, we've never had any trouble of criticism. We've had people just drop out, and they basically say, look, this is too much for me. And I think in fairness, once or twice, we haven't really made it as clear. In the adult education world, some people want to come in, be told what to do, cough up the assessment and leave. And, I mean, I think we're getting a bit better now.
I actually think it's a real pity that people can't be honest, and it's quite hard for people to be assertive and give constructive suggestions, you know, and if they're not enjoying the course. And I wonder if it's the facilitator's role to actually try and draw people out to be a bit more honest and not just disappear. Have you got any idea on how you might do that, Derek?
I was reading Mark's comment, and I didn't hear a word you said. I'm sorry.
I'm just saying people don't seem to be that honest. You know, like they're having trouble with the course, or that something's not very, you know, comfortable for them. They often withdraw rather than come out and say, look, I can't stand this. Where is everybody? Why aren't you telling me what to do? It's almost like they don't want to appear rude, so they withdraw. Have you got any suggestions, Derek, on how the facilitators could actually draw people out a bit more so that they do feel safe and comfortable to be more honest if they're not happy with the way things are going?
Look, I think I have an attitude towards that. The one of the latest sort of high-stakes thing I did was a leadership workshop with some people who were professionals. And I basically started out saying to them, this will be very hard for you. Some of you will find that you're used to managing a personal persona. And so we're going to start easy and work our way in. And I had no dropouts, but I did have some people who spoke to me. I said, you need to talk to me off the record if things get too close. But I had a couple who said, this is hard, but I'm hanging in there. So I think primarily, in this particular case, I would say I managed to say there is value in persevering through this. And, yes, we do have evaluations. We always run evaluations. On my teaching area, I used to teach physics. Now I teach courses on the web, using the web, WebQuest, that kind of thing, on online communities. And learning design, and my latest interest is workshops on leadership, and I've done one of those. But we have the same learning outcomes as our face-to-face courses. In other words, you can come in, in the old days, you used to be able to come in and do a course and go and do it by distance as well, but now the courses in our diplomas we only offer by distance.
I was just thinking, one of the ways that we, I guess, try and gather that feedback in the face-to-face situation is having a class rep and having class rep meetings and that sort of thing. Perhaps a better way of gathering the information in the online context might be to have an anonymous Dropbox where students can, or an anonymous forum or something like that, where students can post comments and other people can other, you're having a cluster, it's a good idea, but this could maybe be another solution as well, where people can post comments and other people can reply to them, and so you can get a sense of how many people are involved in the same sort of thoughts.
I wonder if in some ways that little survey tool that I played with regarding the RSS survey, that could be a continuous little survey that you could gauge feedback on the course and things like that, although you're designing the question, which doesn't really help.
Yeah, reflections is all very well, but I'm just thinking there's a few people in this course who are not actually haven't become part of the community, and I don't even know if they've actually got to the point of putting reflections up on their blog. So, you know, it's how do you make sure that the community is aware that there are people who need a bit of help and support, and yet at the same time not expose people to feel, you know, like, oh, hey, I'm a special case, you know?
Look, in some respects, I'm just a beginner here, but I have another habit which in actual fact is pretty standard among a lot of our pre-service teacher courses, and that is a required post every week right from the beginning. Now, I don't know whether I'm being a little bit overstating the case here, but in some respects you can sense from a post in a reflective journal early on how someone's going. If someone says, oh, I've never done anything like this before, it's like a red rag to a bull. If someone says, if someone writes two or three paragraphs telling a bit of story and how this about this and that, you know they're probably going to be okay, and it's everything in between. And so I think for our professional studies courses at the Teachers College, if you start with monitoring and managing those in the early days of a course, it gives you a really, really good lead as to who you need to watch out for.
Perhaps, I don't know if we have the liberty to think about or rethink how we run courses, considering that this course is talking about facilitating online learning communities, not teaching courses online. Maybe we could accept dropouts and revisit them periodically in the course. There's a few people who haven't posted, as Brahman says, and we could send an email or go and see that person face to face or telephone that person and say, oh, I noticed you haven't really taken up on the course. No big deal. The course is going to run again in exactly the same way. Maybe you could pick up where you left off, or maybe you can come back in when you're feeling ready. I know that at least one of the persons has just been too busy to get to stay with the course, although intended to be with the course, and others, you know, same old, they enrolled in our program and this is one course that they had to take, like it or not, etc. So maybe we could rethink the sort of time frame that we run courses. You know, there isn't necessarily a begin and an end, there's multiple entry points and exit points and all that sort of stuff.
Hi everybody, can you guys hear me? Speaking from my own experience, I really like the idea of the multiple entry points, because as you know, I entered late, and I can see my participation going on beyond the point that the end point of this course. So I think that's a really cool idea, Lee.
One thing we had actually hoped to have with this course, and we did start off having it at the beginning, was the alumni from last year offered their contributions. Now, I don't know what's happened to them, because I haven't seen any of them since we really got underway, and it's a real pity, really, because I'd hoped that they would have buddied up with people. They're busy people as well. So, I mean, that's where I see the beauty of something like this, is that people don't just drop out at the end and they become part of the network, you know, email group, and still contribute as alumni. So it would be fabulous if people were keen to do that, because, I mean, I don't know about everyone else, but I've learnt heaps facilitating this course So you just keep learning, don't you?
I guess in a topic like facilitating online, which is always evolving with the technologies and all that sort of stuff, it's a pretty dynamic subject field. But something repetitive like, I don't know, internal combustion engines concepts of or something like that, which, or not even concepts of, but that might be an exciting area, but something that's pretty much standard and is not changing. Bad example with the internal combustion engine, but that sort of model obviously is not going to wash. I don't think there's multiple entry points and exit points and things like that.
Actually, Lee, I just realised the reason I was finished on time is I've missed a slide. One of the things that I think is really cool about a community-oriented course is the lecturer is not the font of all wisdom, and that you are actually finding stuff, sharing stuff and interacting, or you're finding stuff and reflecting. Here's my romantic rose-coloured view. Even in your internal combustion case, with the internet, it's still possible to have people find new things, put things together in a new way, discover a new approach to doing things. And I may be a rose-coloured romantic here, but I think that's what I think.
It's interesting. I did a one-week avalanche course a few weeks ago. It was a face-to-face course up in the mountains. I really went for the skiing, not for the avalanche learning, but I did learn quite a bit. And it was an intense course. You know, it was pretty much in one ear, out the other. Lecture after lecture, demonstration after demonstration, a period of a week. And retention was, well, you know, as much as the test could do. And then once the test is over, it's done. But I used that group, you know, there was a sense of community because we're all a group of 15 engaged. A group of 15 or 17 people engaged in the skiing and preparing for avalanches and rescuing each other and all that sort of stuff. Obviously that generated a sense of community. And I thought, well, if that community sense was already there, then that should then transfer to an online environment, especially this group, because they already had internet skills, you know, they knew what Facebook was and things like that. So I went and set up an avalanche safety Facebook group, posting all the videos that I recorded of the course, and as well as related videos on YouTube, and starting a few threaded discussion forum ideas, and then inviting everybody to join. Now, interestingly, almost everybody joined, but nothing followed. So that was a bit of a disappointment, actually. So basically the theory that there's a sense of community already happened, and now if we can find a vehicle to sustain that sense, like Facebook, then it should sustain that way, but it didn't.
So I wonder, in that group, maybe the shared focus was just the course, and then once beyond that point, that particular subject area probably wasn't a big enough part of their experience and life and interests to actually maintain it.
I think so. I mean, I thought about that, but I saw evidence to the contrary. You know, there were people exchanging emails to talk about swapping jobs between Japan and Whistler and all of this sort of stuff. They were talking about life outside of the course, perhaps because I had actually invited everyone from the course, that it didn't actually take the community spirit out of it. It just took the course online. And what would have been more of the community, I guess, is identifying individuals in the course who were actively communicating with each other outside the course context, then they would probably be the ones to set up the community. But it was just an experience I'm still thinking about.
See, the thing is, Lee, I think it's a great idea that you put the resources up there, but I'm just wondering, they need something else, like the glue that someone referred to before, I think it was Derek. You know, they need something that actually keeps them going on together, if you know what I mean, like a purpose, that's the big word for me. And how would you do that with that group particularly?
I I don't know, something extending from like putting the records of the lectures and the demonstrations up there, yeah, that's got limited value. But extending on there might be jobs in Whistler, jobs in Japan sort of thing, and Avalanche Part 2, and here are the lectures from the Avalanche Part 2 course in case you're interested in going on further from this Avalanche 1. Rather than it being in arrears, rather than it being a record of everything we've done, which is pretty much what it was, it should be a way forward from what we've done.
Maybe if you could turn the time back, turn the clock back and jump back to that, the end of the course, that might have been useful to just have a talk to everyone and find out, I don't know, you probably have already got a sense of this, what their interests were and that sort of thing. I don't know. Yeah. I'm just trying to think of how you would find that shared purpose. I'm not really sure.
That group, Lee, that you were on, you know, in the course with, actually were going to set up something like a search and rescue operation to save people from avalanches, you'd probably find that they would have to keep in touch with each other because they'd end up having to have practice runs and do things like that. So they had a real group that had to stay together for a particular purpose because they always had to be in readiness for the next avalanche or something like that.
I suppose, except that those networks already exist and they've probably joined those networks, but I don't think they communicate and socialise in the terms of a community on there. Like they maybe communicate professionally and at very limited spells. I think what I was saying before is something to progress onto. Now that we've all experienced this face-to-face, what is the next step? Would have been the good vehicle. That'll be the vehicle I try next time around, rather than here's a document of everything that we just did, nice to meet you sort of thing.
But Lee, how much of that is that failure to engage with the community online, how much of that is people's lack of knowledge, lack of experience to the online technology? The reason I ask that question is that in my experience there are still an awful lot of people that don't use online technology, don't use the social networking technology, and so that's why they're not engaging with it, not because they don't feel that they're a community or they don't want to be a community, or it's more the fear of the technology or they're not wanting to engage with that.
Yeah, I have the same sort of problem. So then how do you get people past that barrier of, hey, we've got a community here, but how do we move them into using online communication channels as well as what's already going on?
You see, to you, Lee, that's the natural thing for you to do, and I guess as you know, I'm finding that myself. But there's a lot of people that doesn't come naturally to.
You're raising some quite significant issues here. I mean, the first question was engagement. That's one of the really, really big. Is a problem worldwide. You've got a community. There are a bunch of researchers in a field X. I mean, how do you engage them online, and then how do you keep something going? And some of the questions around that are things like identity and value and meaning. If you ask the average person who went to this avalanche course, who do they see themselves as? Now, if they do the avalanche course and then they see themselves as an avalanche specialist, they might find the biggest avalanche community they can join. But if it's just something they do in their spare time, they won't have enough sort of oomph to head towards joining the course. There's something around that there. I mean, we're all teachers here, for example, but probably we'll migrate away from this course when we're finished. Unless they aspire to being professional. You're right. I'll finish there and I'll put my head to think about it a bit more for a moment.
I think what holds people back a lot is time commitment. I think we all perceive ourselves to be very busy people and don't have a lot of time for anything, and having to maintain communication through something like this just seems like it's too much time, especially when you've got a bit of a challenge with the technology and it takes you a while to work your way around that, and it just sometimes seems like a bit of a waste of time, maybe.
I just had a bit of an aha moment, I think it is. When I was, just about every course I've ever done, there's been a required reading, a textbook or a manual and stuff like that, or a reading list that you meant to go to the library and photocopy core readings and read before the lecture and things like that. Just about every course that I've done, yeah, I've never gone and got those books, I've never even orientated myself into the library, you know, I usually start emailing other people in the course and have you got that book, did you record that lecture, all that sort of stuff. So I'm thinking that that lack of motivation for me to go and read the required readings is similar to that lack of motivation to join the required social network. The social network and the book in the library are the same thing. It's just that the social network thing, if you don't go and look at that, it shows. Whereas if I don't go and get the book out of the library for that lecture, that doesn't show. Nobody knows if I've borrowed that book or not. And I can sit up the back of the lecture and hide. Whereas if we're requiring social network communication and things like that, well, if you don't engage, if you don't go and do it, then it shows and the whole thing falls down. So I kind of think that we've got the same problem as far as engagement and motivation. It's just transferred to a more libelous resource. Instead of a book, it's now a communication channel.
Yeah, I agree with you there, Mark, that it's not a guarantee of a pass if you do the required readings, but I just wonder why people take a course and then don't engage with what's recommended. It's beyond me, because at least it's a guide to what you might find helpful to help you pass the course. So yeah, what is the key to that? Lead, do you reckon, giving people a range of activities that might actually appeal to people? You know, you pick the one that that appeals, but you don't have to do all of them, perhaps.
I don't know. I just think it's we just have to take this bad with the good and look to the open participation more, because when we get people participating in our course outside of the normal channels of enrollment, so the normal channels would be, I saw a promotion in the local newspaper about this course, I've left high school, maybe I should do something with my life, I'll join this course, or a professional development budget is now due to be spent, I better join something, I know online teaching is coming up and I've got to get recognition for this sort of thing, I better do this course. That sort of stuff, I think, only attracts people with the low motivation, whereas the open enrollment process, not even enrollment, the open participation seems to attract people with high levels of motivation in the first place. And those people can largely carry the people with the low motivation. It will carry maybe a third to even a half of the people with low motivation to pick up their motivation. It won't carry the people who just don't have the motivation from the very beginning. So I'm thinking through here, I think it's the attracting people with high motivation to join the course openly and perhaps freely at first, in the hope that their motivation will carry the low motivation of one or two others.
Hi, Lee. That may well work with a small course like this, for example. But what about, the three-year bachelor midwifery degree that I teach in, for example, trying to keep people's motivation, and that can be very difficult at times. They do it because they have to. They get the registration at the end. I don't know what my original point was, keeping people's motivation in a much longer course can be a lot more difficult.
So maybe chunking the much longer course into a series of smaller courses with that flexible entry and exit points and all that sort of stuff, and then taking a large group of people and breaking them into groups that I don't know, that's just the, off the top of my head, and that would need trial and errors and all that sort of stuff. But, I mean, this course here, the Online Learning Communities, is part of a bigger program of courses, and those bigger programs extend for a year, and I don't know, if we look at master's level of e-learning and stuff like that, this that year program could be part of a five-year program and stuff like that. So similar scaling going on, it's just that this one seems like it's a course in its own right, but maybe it's just a small course and we're a small group of a bigger picture.
What I actually find, Sarah, in some of these programs, you know, especially some of the courses in there that are very theoretical, people often don't understand why they need to know some of the stuff because, you know, they've gone in there to study to be a nurse or a midwife, and they want to be doing that stuff that makes them feel like a nurse or a midwife, but in the interim they've got to learn this other stuff that doesn't seem to be relevant, and I think sometimes that's maybe where the particular issue lies, is that we perhaps don't integrate or connect things quite as well as we could do so that they always feel like they're a nurse or a midwife as they go through.
Yes, Bronwyn, I mean, I'd agree with you wholeheartedly. Our students hate the physiology paper or the psychology paper. They want to get on and do the hands-on stuff. But we even find problems getting people, motivating people and getting them to attend class, even in the clinical papers, the hands-on stuff that you'd really think they'd be interested in. And my other comment is, with our course, there are very strict time frames around not just educationally set by the Polytech, but also set by the profession. So we can't, our students can't dip in and out.
Yeah, that's a pity because I actually think the whole process of formal education, where you have 2 years of study, 3 years of study, learning the whole time, is actually pretty unnatural. And I think that we would probably all be, I think that most people would be much more motivated as students if they could study part-time, go and grab a bit of knowledge, go back into practice and apply it, and continue on, maybe more like the apprenticeship type of system.
I think that's a really good point, David, because I trained as a nurse in the apprenticeship system in the hospital, you know, blood and guts right from day one. So, I mean, you know, but there were still little hiccups where you actually thought, why am I doing this? And I think motivation goes up and down depending on other things that happen in your life. And maybe that's where that community thing comes in that's really important. It's not just about people coming into a classroom, it's about everything else that goes on in their life and all the other people they interact with. Probably helps their motivation in all areas.
So perhaps we're looking at this course as a model or a step in the whole process. I think we've identified a need for a prerequisite understanding of a basic or a level of technology. You know, you need to know how to write to a blog, make a hyperlink, compress an image, record audio and things like that. So you might have a five week course getting up to speed with that type of technology before you enter into this course of understanding online learning communities or online communities and how to facilitate learning in them, which then would lead onto a group of practitioners who continue to communicate in those terms for the life of their career. And we have those sorts of people in Otago Polytechnic who are communicating through an email list called Network Learning. So perhaps that this facilitating online learning communities group is the prerequisite or the preparation course for then going into your organisation and continuing to communicate along these lines with a common understanding and language and all that sort of stuff. So we're just looking at it in steps, a training step, a understanding and an interpretation step, and then a participation on the whole.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure I would agree with that. I think there are some basic skills, but I think I like to when I'm doing something, I like to start right in with the real stuff on day one. And I mean, obviously a doctor can't do that because they can't be slicing someone open or prescribing on day one, but we've found the quicker we get students in our teachers' college courses out of the classrooms, the better. But I realise it's hard. I mean, the midwifery thing, I've been thinking about that, but I don't have an answer for that.
Yeah, I guess doing that, Derek, getting the students out into the classes as soon as possible gives them the context to hang all of their classroom-based learning on. I think it's why one of the reasons I'm enjoying so much learning as a teacher, learning about teaching, is because it's all completely relevant to what I'm interested in learning about, or to my practice.
Look, I'm going to have to go in about 2 minutes. I forgot I double booked and I'm heading out for a meeting in 15 minutes. I think one of the things I will say is that I have a particular domain that I work in. It's online, it's teaching strategies and that kind of thing. And I think I've possibly been through about 15 things that could be considered courses. And on average, one or two or three people out of those courses I still have some kind of contact with. Some of them have gone on with me and joined another group or another entity, or else in one case they've lured me into an online community, and there's one or two people that I still talk to on Skype for less than 2 minutes. Just little connections every now and then. And they regard themselves as being teachers, I'm a teacher, and that connection's gone on. But I don't think there are any community entities where everybody has sort of moved on, holus bolus. But I think in some cases people have merged, and I use that word deliberately, they've merged from our course into a practicing community somewhere. And I think, Lee, that you've got a really good chance of that happening in some of the way you're doing things. In other words, you find a bigger entity a little bit at the end and you go on and join them. That's over and out.
Thanks, Derek. I think the Stephen Sparker from Australia, I've just got the link here, copy and paste. Posted this just recently, his reflections about the necessity for institutions to make their learning openly accessible, and then the trick for, in many subject areas at least, for teachers to be able to prepare people to network the same way Derek just said he does with his profession, and to keep communication channels open and to create new channels, basically socially networking. And the trick is for a teacher to be able to help people make valuable networks like that, to teach them how to network appropriately and how to manage networks to their benefit. And that's actually quite a hard challenge for even my thinking, where, you know, I think I'm pretty experienced with networking and stuff like that, but to be able to teach somebody how to do that, just a totally different headspace. I don't have many ideas on that at all.
Well, thank you very much, Derek. That was really good to listen to some of your points that you made there, and I think you've given us lots to think about. And, thank you so much for that. It's been wonderful. And the group, if you'd like to hang around at the end, we'll have a bit of a question time if people have got anything they want to ask about the course.
I liked Derek's idea of having both closed and open communication channels, so that people could share things which are maybe a bit more intimate than something that they'd be happy to chuck on the web. What are the different options for actually having truly closed communication channels?
Well, if you recall, David, back at the start of this course, we had the Blackboard discussion forum, and you know, like the first activity was for people to put up information about themselves, and that, I guess, is one example of, you know, doing it in a closed place so that people felt comfortable until they got to know the group, putting up information about themselves. And then we had some people who went straight to the blog because they felt quite comfortable putting up, you know, information out in the public forum. So I guess that's a good point, is, you know, do you start with a Blackboard forum? But then we had people saying, well, why are we doing this when we've actually got to all put blogs up? So I guess we've got to, it's getting that balance, isn't it, when people feel comfortable to put themselves out there publicly.
I guess these Illuminate sessions, as long as they're not recorded and thrown up on the course blog, would also be closed.
That's actually a good point. I'm just going to switch off the recording because I don't know if we need to record this, and that'll be, we'll just be the discussion from, we'll just have separate ones, and then we can decide whether we do go with this separate discussion.